Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you ever wanted to know about your favourite sneakers. Hosted by me, Jason Coles, and the infamous, the incorrigible Kish Cash.
Oh my gosh.
How's it going with you, Kish? You're looking killer today.
Jace, so are you, mate. Do you know what I mean? You're looking very tonal. You've gone ninja today, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, I like to keep it dark some days, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Undercover manoeuvres and all that lot, do you know what I mean? I'll tell you what, we've got a wicked one today, though. You know, we're going to be speaking to Erin Narlock, and this lady is probably the most plugged-in person regarding Reebok, because she's responsible for maintaining the Reebok archive at the Reebok HQ in Boston. So if she doesn't know, it didn't happen, basically. So we're going right to the oracle with this. And we're going to be discussing the Reebok Freestyle, which is a significant shoe, such a significant shoe in terms of, you know, category genres and all this kind of other stuff that we're going to discuss with Erin. And also up until the end of the 80s, because Reebok's history is quite deep. And there's no way we could ever go in fully just in one episode of this. But yo, I swear we're going to have a great one. I really do.
Absolutely. It's going to be a good one, Kish. It's one of those brands, you know, we don't celebrate it enough in the UK. It's originally, you know, a great British brand that kind of found its success in the US. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's join Erin. I mean, she's going to tell us all about it.
Hey, Erin, how you doing? We're here in London, you're there in Boston, and through the marvel of modern technology and the fact that Goalhanger are powering this bad boy, we're on the go. You work for Reebok, am I correct?
I do. I work for Reebok. I head up their global archive here in Boston,
so,
believe it or
okay.
not.
From what Jace has been saying, you're such the oracle. If you don't know, it didn't happen.
Right? Whoa,
With regards to Reebok's history.
Right, no pressure, right? I steal. Okay.
We just want to make sure we're talking to the right person. I think we definitely are, you know. So where does the Reebok story start?
Yeah, so Reebok draws its heritage all the way back to 1895 when J.W. Foster, I know, right?
Crazy.
When J.W. Foster makes his first running spike. Mm-hmm. In the northwest of England, mm-hmm. so outside of Manchester in Bolton, and that's really where our story begins. Foster will have his two sons join the family business, and they'll mm-hmm. really be focused on a lot of British sports.
Yeah.
So track and field, fell running, walking, cycling for the first, you know, 50 years of the business.
Wow.
Yeah. And it'll be J.W. Foster's grandsons, Jeff and Joe Foster, that will join the family business in 1948 and 1952. And that's where we'll really see the start of what we know today to be Reebok.
Just to flip back, though, you just put a little cheeky thing back. You said running spikes. Was that a thing that most sports companies were doing then? Or was how many other sports companies were there at that period of time?
So this is definitely, right, we're going to see more and more people get involved in athletics and mm-hmm. leisure activities. And this is truly an innovation of the time.
When we
look at running spikes, and I do, like, seriously, like, a teacher kind of have a print-off to show you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sorry. So this performance shoe looks more like a ballet flat. Mm-hmm. But it was truly for performance, and these tracks were not the tracks we know today, but were more like dirt tracks. But more people were gathering together to watch competitive pedestrianism and running. Oh. And this is where you see different Harrier clubs, right? This tried and true and really embedded, I think, in some British culture form. And J.W. Foster was part of it. He was one of the first to do this.
So basically, running spikes were invented by the British?
Yeah, I think...
Hey! That's great! Hey. Chase, we're winning, mate. We're finally winning something.
And I can be cheeky and say, even Adi collected Fosters. So Whoa.
Adidas look.
Yeah, Adidas.
He collected Fosters. Wow. Yeah.
Right? Oh my gosh, this way it's crazy how things have come a bit full circle with that, but we'll get into that. You know, but that's quite remarkable.
Right?
It really is. Yeah.
But really dedicated to the best for the athlete. Like fine quality leather, handmade. And that tradition will be passed down. And what you'll see, though, by 1948 and 1952, is the world had radically changed. We were living in a new modern age, right? And Jeff and Joe had national service, and they had the opportunity to go to mainland Europe and see, okay, what were the other brothers, what were they up to, right?
Oh,
and
how, the other brothers you referring to?
The other brothers.
Yeah. The other brothers. Sounds like a movie.
Yeah, right? And how were they, like, how are they truly transforming athletic footwear? And what was modern athletic footwear beginning to look like? I mean, we can all identify being young. I mean, that was a while ago for me, but being young.
I'm still young. I don't know what you're saying. I think we all still look pretty young.
But really not wanting to, like, lean into the status quo, but being hell-bent and determined on paving your own path and wanting what you don't have. And when Jeff and Joe came back and brought new ideas to the family business and said, hey, we see a great opportunity here to change what had been really a static formula for J.W. Foster's for the last quite 50 years, they received pushback from the generation before them. And
that's typical human behavior, though, isn't it, really?
Totally.
Do you think that the fact that Dassler's were collecting Foster's shoes, it was an attempt to analyze what they were doing and going, we can do this better, we can improve this?
Of course. I mean, any great designer, any great craftsman or cobbler, they're going to know their craft inside and out. I mean, this is just the way great designers work. We all know that, right? In the business, that when you meet great designers and developers and innovators, what they're going to do is turn something inside out. They want to learn from the best. And at that time, the best was J.W. Foster. And what's great about competitive innovation is it only gets better with better people on the field. The innovation of removable spikes, right? So screw-in spikes, whatever it might be, those cross-pollinated, I think, athletic footwear at the time. What you'll see then is Jeff and Joe, when they received the pushback from their family, they were not okay with waiting for that next generation. What they then did is they went off on their own. And in the fall of 1958, they will create what we know today to be Reebok.
When you talk about this kind of a split, I mean, was it like a big argument, or were they kind of sent off, you know, with their parents' blessings? Was it anything like the Dassler's, obviously, that, you know, where there was a huge argument?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is where, as someone like myself, who's a steward of a story, this is where personal history is a little different than brand history, right? So there, of course, there was discussions, right? And Jeff and Joe went to night school. They then furthered the craft of footwear on their own. They took on debt by themselves to create Reebok. And Reebok was really, like, small. And it was then that generation, so their wives working with them, or a motley crew of hardworking, right, like, gritty, relentless, tenacious, devoted to building something for themselves. Group.
Right, so it was a real family business then.
The difference between, like, an investor or a serial entrepreneurial person and a founder is going to be blood, sweat, and tears and passion. And that's right. What Reebok was born out of. And that has a galvanizing spirit to it. And it will be, so by the mid-1970s, Reebok will absorb J.W. Foster. As the generation before them passes away, they will take on J.W. Foster, and it will become part of Reebok International. They'll also create footwear on behalf of Foster's called Foster's of England. So there is some time where there's some exchange, but really Jeff and Joe were dedicated to athletic footwear, specifically running, so road racing. So the running boom that we see in the United States in the 1970s will take hold in Europe in the 1960s. And that fact will really play into the benefit for Jeff and Joe getting to North America by the late 1970s. Having that cachet of belonging to kind of this European heritage per se. Like, no, they had that built-in credibility of being a brand from Europe who knew running and had a decade of running in their back pocket, you could say.
What was the origin behind the name of Reebok? How did they come up with that?
So Reebok's name before it was Reebok was Mercury Sports Footwear. And there's only 18 months of production where it's known as Mercury Sports Footwear, because when they go to register this name, the agent that they see was like, that's great that you want it. It's registered to someone else. So you're going to need to buy the name. And this was more money than Jeff and Joe had. So he said, and this is kind of when I talk about the legend and lore of a brand, this is when Joe Foster tells the story and we have his oral history. The way he describes it is this agent looks out the window and he points to a sign and he says, you see that over there? He's like, you need a name like that. And he was pointing to a Kodak sign. He's like, it means something and nothing all at the same time. So they go back and they look through the dictionary and they try to find our words, because running, they really like running sounding words. And they come to select Reebok, which is the, you know, American spelling of the Afrikaans Reebok, which is a small gazelle. Very, very small, like a teeny, teeny, teeny bok from the southern part of Africa. So, and that is the only name out of the whole list of names that clears. So they become Reebok. And they also use Mater Tectura, so our word font, right, our font, as early as 1975. And we can, like, detect this because it was only distributed through three font houses in the world. One in Berlin, one in London, and one in the United States. And this is the same font that we know that Macintosh used, right, for the initial Apple. Yeah. So designed by an Austrian designer, Othar Mader. So, and this then, along with some parts of our design DNA, like the two directional arrows that are now part of the star crest, start to form in the 1960s and really help to give Reebok its personality.
Yeah. You had the original running pump and the significance of that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of lore around the use of J.W. Foster's, like, throughout the 1920s and 30s. But these are all stories, and these are stories even when, you know, Jason and I talked the last time. These are all stories that we've utilized as a brand as early as 1981, especially like the 1924 Olympics or any of those moments in time. That's really difficult now for myself or my team to verify these very specifically, because these accounts also then begin to live in the legend and lore of a brand and of J.W. Foster's.
Because the Chariots of Fire, you know, and the story about that. The athletes there were wearing JW Foster spikes, right? Is that correct?
So those, that's one of those stories that we can't, we haven't been able to verify by primary source material. So I haven't been able, nor has my team been able to locate something definitively in writing, right? And that's the way we work as a group of archivists and historians. We like to go to the source, but that's not to say there isn't power in story, because those stories are very powerful and they do live through objects and through events, for sure.
Exactly. And having an Olympic gold medal winner back in that era, that must have had a significant effect for the Foster's brand.
Yes. And J.W. Foster for sure was, they provided spikes. They're called the New Haven spikes for Yale University. And that we have documentation of that. We have,
oh, so you can verify this one?
Yes. Okay. This,
this
I can
is a good one. Okay. All right.
Yeah. But a contract between Yale, so this Ivy League school and their track program, and then J.W. Foster's, and providing them specifically with these shoes called New Haven and referencing New Haven, Connecticut, right? We have the shoes also in the archives collection. So this to us is also those aha moments when we locate a document or we can verify it in external context. And that for us is a little bit of the Indiana Jones of our job.
Yo, that's the thing, you know, this research, all these things. What's the most interesting tidbit of history that you've come across and you've been like, really? And, you know, your jaw has dropped.
Like, I don't know. It's a crazy thing. Like, crazy times when we get to acquire pieces. So acquiring when we were in London and we went to a sports, like a vintage sports shop. And we talked with the owners and they're like, oh, yeah, you're from Reebok, huh? I might have something you might be interested in. And he goes to the back and he comes out with a pair of probably 1962, 63 running spikes, Reebok running spikes, really beautiful veg tan, robin's egg with a nice burnt umber like color to it. Mm. And it actually has the label on the inside of our first distributor, and I'm with the head of our footwear collection, and she is like properly geeking out. I'm like, just play it cool, because now we're gonna negotiate on price. So there's that. or hunting down an original, like when Reebok worked with Chanel in 2000 and did runway.
I nearly had my hand on a pair of those. I didn't have the money at the time. My friend had them and wanted £800 for them. I didn't have £800, and they're worth way more than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so for us, we have the white and gray example, and so Stephanie Schaff on the archives team, she did the research to find the video online that shows the ready to wear runway show, where you can see the Instapump Fury walking down the runway. This is really significant for Reebok because this is 2000, so this is pretty early on, and it's worn by women, and for us as a brand, as we'll talk about with the freestyle, it's even more significant. And while we have the gray and the white, the triple blacks are like grail. They're only very, very few triple blacks. So for me, it was hunting down, okay, who is a part of this? Who is a part of this project internally? Where are they now? So it was a British guy, and I contacted him, had a great talk with him, you know, and found out the whole story. And then having the opportunity to acquire a pair of those triple blacks and bring them home, right, and have them part of the collection. I mean, it is so powerful for a brand to build confidence and owning that part of who we are for my colleagues, for our brand fans, for the future of the brand. It builds the aura, right? It helps us connect where our memory can meet our imagination and fuel the future. It's not always about looking back, but it's about giving more gas in that tank and like taking us to where we need to go. So
yeah, totally.
So when we're working with Margiela, right, when we're talking about why is it significant to reimagine the Instapump Fury and present it as a tabby boot, it totally makes sense, right?
One key thing, though, is that I'm trying to sort of work out is, how did Reebok conquer America? Because the thing is, the amount of you know, if you look at it in music terms, because I'm the music guy, right?
Right,
it's like, how, you know, how the golden ticket, the golden egg, that you know, the tough nut to crack is, how do we crack America? You know, the Beatles did it, but you know, how did Reebok do this, you know?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. No, it was more than that at the time. As I mentioned before, we're going to bring with us the knowledge of running from the 1960s. And throughout the 1960s and 70s, Reebok will be coming over to the United States to the National Sports Goods Show and trying to find a distributor in North America. And this is the hustle. This is the grind. This will take a long time. And Joe Foster makes an introduction with Paul Fireman. Paul Fireman is a businessman based out of Boston. At the time, he has a camping goods store. And what he does is he takes a chance on Reebok. And Reebok will come to North America in 1979. We will set up shop for Reebok, like officially set up. I mean, you could buy Reeboks and bring them to the US, but Reebok will set up a US headquarters in July of 1979 and have Paul Fireman will have exclusive distribution rights to Reebok in 1979 and the US, Canada, Mexico, and some other parts of the Americas. Now, what Paul Fireman will do and what will happen concurrently is that running boom that like takes over the United States. You know, we see Jimmy Carter running, everyone's running, we're all running, and it's amazing. That running boom will go
and bust. Jane Fonda as well, right? With all that stuff, right?
Yeah, well, what will start to happen is the running boom goes bust and Reebok isn't big enough. So we're faced with this dilemma pretty soon upon our arrival. So Paul also identifies that a lot of trends in the United States will originate on the West Coast, right? So he will go to the West Coast and he will meet with a gentleman named Angel Martinez. Angel Martinez at the time owned this running store that he ran in tandem with Runner's World magazine. I should mention what also helped us come to North America was we received 3 shoes with 5-star ratings by Runner's World magazine. So whoa, it was like the stamp of approval at the
what
time.
Shoes were they?
They were the Aztec.
Yeah.
Which you might know. The Orbit and the 10K. They're all pretty nice looking shoes. And when Paul Fireman meets Angel Martinez, who is an incredible individual, and we could spend the whole another 45 minutes just talking about what an impression Angel has made on Reebok, is he meets Angel and he convinces him to be Reebok's first technical running rep. So what Angel is doing up and down the West Coast is he is opening up Reebok accounts with different retailers. And Angel is really, you know, he's embedded in the market. He is incredibly observant. He's noticing a trend, right? He's noticing while he might sell Reeboks So some things are happening that when he's home with his wife, Frankie, he's going to take these new kinds of classes with her. They're called aerobics classes. They're being held in what used to be utilized for squash courts at this like different sports clubs. And he's noticing that these are just generating large groups of women. And the women are gathering together, and their footwear could be jazz shoes, which would have like a hard leather bottom and wouldn't be proper, like wouldn't help you to stop on the floor. You could be wearing nothing at all, so you're going barefoot. Or you might be wearing some very ugly running shoes that aren't proper, like properly designed for this athletic activity, right? They're too high off the ground. You could roll an ankle. It's just not designed for the kind of stop motions that were happening within these aerobic dance classes. The other thing he was noticing is that these women are all dressing alike, right? They're looking kind of to their instructor and mimicking their dance, their appearance. He said that, you know, if you took a dance class on Monday, by Wednesday, everyone would look like one another. So he also mentioned the other thing that he noticed was selling very well when he was opening up accounts was sports bras. Like the first sports bras were also just starting to fly off the shelves. So with this insight, like we have large groups of women. They're working out for the first time really in the United States together. They're sweating, they're finding community, and they're not being equipped with what they need. He's like, we have an opportunity here. Reebok has this opportunity. We should pivot from offering running shoes and offering them specifically a shoe for this activity. So he calls up Paul Fireman from California to Boston, and I cannot do a Boston accent. I'm not from Boston, so I'm not gonna like make you listen to mine. And he tries to convince him of, you know, the validity of this risk. And this is what I love about Reebok, is that when there's an opportunity and when everyone gets behind an idea, no matter how big or how small, it's the people who make it happen. And this is a time where, after Paul listened, everyone from Steve Liggett, who was doing development, to Paul Brown, who was then doing design, everyone in Reebok, they just turn, pivot, and make it happen. So the first sketch for the freestyle, we have dated from an oral history of like March of 1982, and it'll go to market by that fall. And what will happen, and this is something we've talked about, is through time, like just through time and the amount of times we've talked about the origin story of freestyle, is the window of time it took for adoption by the audience just shortens. Like, this is the fallacy of memory, right? Like, when we remember the past, it's always greater than it actually was.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Because it helps you make sense of the present. But what we now know is it took weeks, if not months, for those initial freestyles to be adopted by the community. And we can see this from a press release that we have from the early 1980s, where Paul Fireman is quoted, and even some documentation and ledgers. But what happens is Reebok does get the instructor to adopt them. And once those instructors adopt the footwear, the audience does as well. All of the participants in aerobics do.
So was this the first sort of example of like seeding some product out to key influencers? Yeah, you wear the footwear and then we're going to see what happens.
Yeah, so definitely there was an incredible grassroots effort. There was cross promotion with different clubs. Dance Free with Reeboks, buy a pair of Reeboks and dance free for 2 weeks. And this will then just light a fire under the freestyle, and it will turn red hot and it'll sell out. And it is it is really upon the freestyle that all of the success of Reebok is built in the United States. And it starts with the freestyle, and let's break it down. It is built for women, specifically for women. And this is truly a game changing shoe. So it isn't like, let's just make this a size run that goes to a 4, a US 4. Let's just tweak the colors. Let's really consider the last and how the last is built. The aesthetics of the shoe mimicked or mirrored the aesthetics of dance. So the first 3 shoes were offered in white and baby blue and pink. And everyone's like, oh my God, Trinket and Pinket. But at that time, pastels and just the dance aesthetic was really, really popular. And to flip it, in the 1970s, the running aesthetic was throughout culture, right? The track suits and the kind of the vests and so on. So what Reebok will then do is by 1983, what we'll see is we will offer it in a high top, right? So the freestyle high is the true long-lasting icon, and we can talk about that. We'll offer it in a men's version. So this is probably the only time, guys. Like the pow pow. Like women will go first, and you will want what we have, and we're like, yeah, sure, we'll make something for you. Yeah. And so they create a shoe called the Exo Fit. And why is it called the Exo Fit? Because men don't want to do aerobics, they want to do exercise, EX. So that's how you get the Exo Fit.
That's amazing. Because I can't think of any other examples where that's happened, where, you know, the women's shoe actually completely influences what the men end up wearing.
Yeah. But what we know and what's so significant is that the freestyle is continued to be worn by men. And this is incredible, right? So the other thing that happens, so we have the origin story of the freestyle, but the birth of it as an icon is what's most significant. That doesn't happen on the West Coast. That happens on the East Coast. That's going to happen in New York, right? So right. That second birth is the one that will last the longest. Mm-hmm. And we have images of Grandmaster Flash wearing the freestyle high. And in the triple red, where we would call it the color bomb. Or if you look at the Robin Williams live from the Met in 1985, he's wearing the freestyle high. So in triple red. So that adoption of a shoe by men, it's incredible. And
that's amazing.
One of my favorite Reeboks of all time is actually a women's aerobic shoe. It's the Reebok Instructor. I've got a pair somewhere, right? In wherever my archive. It's the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful shoes I ever have ever owned. And I've spoken to Ian Paley about this, and I go, dude, can you help bring that back? And he can't even find an image of it, right? He went through all the catalogs. He goes, yeah, but Kish, where is it? And I'm like, dude, it's not that. And so I'm just, he doesn't know it exists. He doesn't even know what it is. And obviously he's working with you guys. But the thing is, if there's one thing that I can gain out of this conversation is please bring that shoe back. This is me being a fanboy. I want to wear that shoe again because it was just, it was a beautiful shoe. Do you recall that shoe?
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. The other thing is, and this is interesting, is Reebok, it becomes this truly American spirited brand. And this will happen in the course of, you know, a decade. Mm. While we were born in the UK, we will only use the Union Jack when we move to the US. Like that's the first time we start using it. It will use it in all of our window boxes.
So it wasn't on the shoes before the move to America?
No. Mm-mm.
That's insane. So the whole British element of the brand was the key selling point. This is British. This is that level of quality.
Yeah, quality. high class, right? Like that kind of.
I actually remember on the shoe boxes for a while, you used to have the whole lid of the box was a Union Jack, wasn't it?
Yep, and that was an innovation as well. I think that whole packaging design was an innovation because at that time, sports stores, it was open box display, right? So your boxes were out. So you wanted something to draw the eye in for the consumer. The other innovation was the bottoms of men's footwear. The bottoms of the boxes were blue. The bottoms of women's footwear boxes were red. You could easily determine if it was a men's or a woman's shoe. There are just things about Reebok that I think about it and I'm just like, the story is so great, right? This experimental brand that like really moved and tried new things and gave up and really, as I mentioned, was born in the UK, but gave up parts of being in the UK, right? Joe will sell his rights to Reebok in 1984 in order for it to get the kind of investment it needed for production in Korea to meet the demand for freestyle and wow. all of the fitness shoes, right? Those garment leather shoes that we know today as classics. And that idea of having a place you're from, but having a place that embodies your spirit. I mean, that's Reebok. Reebok is this incredible new world brand. We'll be made by the people who come to us. We're all yeah. about the potential of the individual who chooses Reebok as their brand. We're not a hero worshiping brand. We're like the every man and woman brand. So you can like put on some white Reebok classics and rock them, right? And that to me is more exciting.
The thing is, the freestyle, if I'm not mistaken, propelled Reebok to become the number one sports company in the world. Is that right?
That is right. By 1986, we will jump over Adidas and Nike to be number one.
Wow. Incredible.
And
wow.
And that, right? And yeah. it is.
Because especially when you, in the US at least, you know, Reebok just kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And basically just whipped those guys to the side, yeah. didn't they? I mean, yeah. I can't think of many, you know, brands that have done that in history.
But like, let's be honest, they did it because they included women in that. So, I mean, that's the insight is know who your audience could be, right? Know who your consumer could be. Mm-hmm. And really, I think that the intuitive nature that Anhal brought, like, where are they? What are they doing? What do they need? Mm. And what can we give them? And yeah. then they made it their own, right? And then it was made an icon in New York, right? Yeah. It was made an icon by the people who wore it in all of the different colorways. It was made an icon when it went down the red carpet. It was made an icon when, you know, Grandmaster Flash wore it. It was made an icon when artists took it and customized it and made it even cooler. It was made an right. icon when, you know, when it was celebrated as this symbol of, you know, feminism and, yeah. you know, intersectionality of what it is to be, you know, for this, it's this brand.
Absolutely groundbreaking. One of the best silhouettes yeah. I've ever, you know, seen ever. It's a classic and it's still in production to today, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, yep. Is it the best selling aerobic shoe of all time?
Oh, I don't know. I've never gotten that question.
I'm curious because I'm thinking, yeah, I'm thinking what other shoe actually embodies is the personification of fitness and aerobics, and it is that shoe. It's the freestyle. Has to be, right? Jace, can you think of another shoe in you know, your esteemed, you know, deep, you know, research?
There's just nothing that really yeah. comes close to the freestyle. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was such an amazing shoe. I mean, you know, coming, I suppose, to present day, and I guess one of the legacies of the freestyle is probably, you know, I've noticed more than any other brand, Reebok has this kind of deep connection with women, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we say we always start with women. We think of women first, and I think that's part of our brand identity. Even when Anhal came to Reebok and we got his you know, his story, he always talked about this feminine force that Reebok embodied, a different way of seeing and doing things. And we see that today. You know, Freestyle will turn 40 years old in 2022.
Whoa. Tell me you've got some things planned for that.
I'm going to wink to that. Yeah.
Okay.
So
love it. Your latest brand ambassadors are just, you know, very, very powerful women in their own right. And Cardi B, who's dominating rap, just period. And Gal Gadot, you know, she's Wonder Woman. You know, I mean, what a powerful icon that is. Victoria Beckham, who's literally, you know, just torn up the rule book and just gone, this is what I want to do and this is how I'm going to do it. And she's an icon for the greatest reasons why. And then Natalie Emmanuel, amongst others, right? I mean,
yeah, Natalie Emmanuel's, she's amazing. I mean, like, she's incredible to be around and to listen to her talk and her practice and her yoga. And I think what's great about the people that choose to work with Reebok and we choose to work with is it's really looking at the different consumers that are drawn to us, right? And why they're drawn to us and making sure that we can have a representation. They can see themselves in us and we can speak to them. And I think it's bringing people that really amplify our message in a variety of different ways and that are fun and irreverent. And it really can also, you know, Reebok has never been a super serious brand. Like, we have been, you guys are in the UK, so the belly, right? There are really funny commercials that we've done that we're not, you know, and to have people, and Cardi B is one of those personalities.
The nails commercial is just incredible. I saw that and I just thought, you know, no one is doing anything like that in this game.
Yeah, and just not to take ourselves so seriously, right? We're not about just truly incredibly competitive sports, right? Our first tagline when Reebok is publicly traded is an excerpt from a longer quote from Jackie Robinson called, "Because life is not a spectator sport," right? So don't sit in the grandstands, like get out of them, come down on the field. Why? Because life is not a spectator sport. Just get involved, just do something, be active. And what we'll see happen, especially with the classics that we're talking about, is those shoes will meld like fitness and or performance and lifestyle.
We're seeing the return of the Club C. The Club C is having a fantastic moment. And is that a tennis shoe originally?
Yep. So Club C, it was born on the court, but has lived and continues to live. It's celebrating 35 years this year. It is a beautiful understated silhouette that continues to be reimagined by younger consumers. It's nondescript, it's a low profile.
It just looks so
beautiful and classic.
Yeah.
Just
the toweling lining.
Oh,
well.
Yeah.
Oh. Come on. Yeah, right. It's just super cozy. And then you've got collabs such as Palace did with the workout, right?
So
you've got one of the hippest skate brands in the world, Palace, wanting to do the workout. And, you know, I know loads of dudes who skated in the workout. And it's probably the number two, you know, aerobic shoe, freestyle, you know,
H-strap, right?
Right, yeah.
It is a fitness shoe. Between 1982 and 1987, those classic performance shoes that we are talking about, they're born, but they continue to live today and they're reinvented and imagined. There's always something new. The classic leather, right? There's this, like, it continues to be that retro running shoe that is always on, right?
Yeah. And the running silhouettes from the 80s when I first came across the brand as a young kid, you know, still, I think it's the LX 1500. That's one of them. The GL 1600, phase twos, all these of shoes, you know, they just look still to this day. They're absolutely phenomenal shoes, really.
Yeah. Good design is timeless, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some of the designers that you had working, you know, th- throughout the years at Reebok. I mean, you've had Stephen Smith, he was one of them, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yep. And worked on the Instapump Fury. And
yeah, exactly. Which is something that I think we, you know, Jason and I want to get involved and talk to you about. We're not going to have enough time today to get into the whole second part and possibly third part of Reebok, because we've only just, you know, skimmed the surface, because things really start to heat up from those moments right there.
In 1986, Reebok will get on the basketball court, right? And just with some of the BB series and just some of our classic basketball, and then how do we pivot in the 90s and really express ourselves with some of the greatest silhouettes? So we talk about Shaq, but we also have AI, Allen Iverson, right? We have the question and the answer, these two incredible legacy shoes that just live on and are iterated upon.
And the whole Michael Chang story prior to that, of course.
Right.
You know, one of the best tennis
Venus
shoes of all time.
Williams.
Yeah.
Like the Williams sisters, we have documentation of as early as 91.
Wow.
So that we'll work with them. And one of the last things Angel will do is sign an endorsement contract with Venus. The highest paid endorsement contract at the time in 2001. And that will, you know, for us, that will be something that we're incredibly proud of to this day, is the impact that they made. Like, not us, let's like be honest, that the Williams family has made on tennis and for the sport and for women and for young girls of all types. And that we just got to be a part of it. I mean, that speaks, and I have to say, that speaks to that the human element of Reebok is so much about the people behind the brand care so much about the legacy and the stewardship and the people we work with and how we bring that to life in the most authentic way possible. And it's this relentlessness, this tenacity, this belief in something that's bigger and better than us. And it's like taking like a little bit of humility into what we do every day and knowing that it'll be better for the brand in the end.
We're definitely going to have a second episode, Kish.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, Jace. Definitely.
So massive thanks for coming on today, Erin. You know, it's been a real pleasure talking to you and hearing all about Reebok. And, and, you know, as Kish and I said, you know, there's so many more stories that we want to cover, so definitely we'll get you back if you'll have us.
Oh my gosh, you guys have been amazing. It's just been my pleasure. I could do this. I mean, we should get Ian Paley on. Like, Ian Paley is great, and we could just talk with Ian Reebok. That would be so much fun.
But anything. We definitely want to talk to Ian.
Okay. All right. Thanks again, Erin.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay.
Jace. Oh my gosh, I'm just trying to process all that stuff that Erin just like gave
Incredible,
us. And that was
it?
Just like, yo, she's only up to 89, mate.
I know, there's so much more to come.
Yeah, it's mad. It really is mad. It's just like, she was going in depth, she's gone off on tangents, and there's so many things that we need to explore. We need to, you know, when we're going to get her back on, we've got to, you know, we've got to talk to her about, and that's just that moment.
I'm already looking forward to the next step, Kish. It's going to be great.
Yeah, no, definitely, man. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So before that, we've got a few questions in from the listeners before we go. So let's dive into those. So we got first one up is from Elise Watson. And this is probably a good one for you, Kish. How should I be lacing my kicks?
I think she should be lacing them so they don't fall off her feet, you know. And I'm a fine one to talk because I wear my laces on tight, you know. And I just, somehow they miraculously stay attached to my feet. Basically, I'd lace them however you want. There's so many different ways you can lace them, you know. It depends on what suits you and what your personality is and how you look and your style at the end of the day. There's no wrong or right way. There's just a way that works for you at the end of the day. But don't, for whatever reason, I hate it when someone ties them up so tight it looks like they're constricting the blood flow.
Yeah,
not a fan of that. But apart from that, yeah, you're good to go.
Cool. Okay, and the next one from Jack and Jill. What are your favourite sneakers from the movies?
Ooh, from the movies. Oh, Air Mag. The moment in Back to the Future Part 2 where you see the Air Mag, the self-lacing shoe. That's an iconic moment. That definitely is one of them. I think there's a pair of Adidas basketball shoes. I can't remember what they had. They're massive trefoil on the ankle. And it was a sort of plastic strap. But they were a basketball shoe. They weren't distributed in the UK because Adidas basketball shoes in the 90s, for some reason, they were a bit hit and miss. But it's in Boomerang. There's a guy in Boomerang who's got them on. I think it's the delivery dude or whatever. He's got them on. They're like, boom. And I remember seeing him in New York in the East Village years ago in a thrift shop. And for the life of me, I pulled him. I felt like, oh, my God, I found him. And they were my size. And for some inexplicable reason, I don't know why, I didn't buy them. And since crazy. That moment, I've just been like, you know. So that's one of them. There's the moment in Juice where you see Omar Epps trying on different shoes. And he puts the Baltoros on. So, the Nike Baltoros in that scene. That's a good one. But there's been so
that's
many
the thing.
Movie
there
shoes.
Have been so many. Really. I mean, for me...
Now, what about for you, Jace?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm just going to go for one because it's the one that really kind of made me even aware that Nike existed, and that's the Bruin that Michael J. Fox wore in Back to the Future. And just that beautiful plain white shoe with a big, fat, red, chubby check on it. Amazing. And
so class. In fact, you've got to give a shout out to the doc in that, you know, Christopher Lloyd, because he's got the orange Vandals.
He has, isn't he?
They retroed them a couple of years ago. I've got a pair right here, over there. And now they're going for crazy money.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really bizarre. I got a pair of the Bruins when Nike retroed them just a few years ago. Yeah. And the craziest thing was I found them not in London, not in New York, nowhere in the States. I was actually in Herzog, the hometown of Adidas and Puma. Unbelievable. Right. But hey, that's the way it works.
That's probably why they were there. Yeah. No one would dare walk around in a pair of Nikes in that town, I'm sure.
Well, I always found it funny that Nike have got an outlet store pretty much just across the road from the Puma factory. So yeah, only Nike would do that. Okay, so the final one we've had in is, it's not even a question. It's a pretty cheesy joke.
This is a dad joke.
Sneaker jokes are dad jokes.
I thought
we discussed
it's meant to be a dad joke free zone.
Well, come on. People love sending these in, but here we go.
It's good.
What did the sneaker say when it sneezed?
I ain't got a clue, mate.
A shoe.
Oh, my God.
I actually can't believe I even told that joke. But,
I can't believe I'm laughing at it. Oh, my days. That's terrible.
Guys, listeners, if you want to keep sending those in, feel free. I mean, we'll go through the pain of reading them out for you. But, So, look, I think, you know, great episode, Kish. I think, I think we had a lot of fun in this one. It was great. So, I hope the listeners and, you know, enjoying it as much as we did. That's it for another one. Thanks for listening. Remember to send your questions and your silly jokes as well to us on Twitter or Instagram to @soulful_podcast. You can also follow Kish @KishCash1 and me @MadeByJace.
Exactly. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you like it, which I'm sure you do. Otherwise, why you'd be here right now listening to us, okay? And also, make sure you tell your friends, tell your family, support, spread the word, because the thing is, you know, I'm sure you just don't want us to make us your little dirty secrets, you know what I mean? We really want to proliferate throughout the world and, you know, share the knowledge that we procure with you guys, you know what I mean? So, stay healthy, and, we're going to be back real soon.